Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cripple Stomp. I know it's been a while, but hopefully I'll make up for it by having a fantastic guest for you all. So, without further ado, I'll throw it over to my fantastic guest to introduce themselves. Over to you, guest.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Baz. This is brilliant. My name is Sarah Dauncey. I'm a professor of Chinese society and disability at the University of Nottingham. And I'm really excited to be with you today to talk about, well, whatever you want to talk about. You tell me.
Yeah. So my first question then, nice easy one, why China?
Oh, that's a good one. I've been visiting China now for around 30 years. I did a degree in Chinese at the University of Durham. So I wanted to get away from England. I wanted to go somewhere really exotic. I wanted to see new places. And I thought, yeah, China will do. What I didn't know at the time was when I started my course and I was getting ready to go out to China to live there for a year, was that the Tiananmen Square incident happened. I don't know whether many people actually remember it now, but in 1989, there were some demonstrations in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. And they were crushed by the Chinese government. There were democracy demonstrations. And so there I was, all ready to go out to China. And it wasn't the safest place to be. But I think going somewhere that I didn't know and really intrigued me and had a little bit of mild peril about it was something that really attracted me. So I did go, and I lived there for a year in Beijing and learn more of the language, got to know the people, traveled around a lot. And I think it really opened my mind a lot. You know, there's a lot that you can't do when you're still sat at home and you're surrounded by the same people. I wanted to sort of challenge myself and get over there and just experience something different. And it's become my whole life. I did a PhD in Chinese. And now I'm a professor of Chinese society. The disability bit came a bit later, but that's why I went to China and I still do Chinese now.
Can you remember, I know this is a test of your memory, I suppose, but can you remember your first time you touched down in China?
Yes, definitely, because I can remember I went with some of my classmates from the university and we touched down in Beijing Airport. And I think that sense of excitement was, it was so, I could just feel it running through my body because it was, I was so far away from home. This is the time in 1989, 1990 was a time when there was no internet. You couldn't just ring home. So I had that sense that I was going somewhere, you know, cut off really from everything that I knew. And of course, you're walking through the airport and nobody's speaking English. All the signs at that point in time, I think, were very few in English. I'd learned, you know, how to read some of the characters and, you know, speak some of the language, but it doesn't really prepare you for being immersed in another culture. And I think from then on, I realized that I would have to, you know, keep my eyes and ears open and try to immerse myself in Chinese culture and try to think about why people acted in different ways and why people would say things that sounded strange and unusual. To me, I mean, one of the things that we used to travel around the country a lot on the train. And the train is an amazing place in China because that's where all the best conversations happen. You sit there, people get talking to you. Of course, when they find out that you can speak Chinese, they want to know more about who you are and what you do. And they're always really interested in how much money you earn and how much your house cost and all these really personal questions that you would never ask somebody in England on first meeting. But you seem to get they're very direct and forthright in their questions. And, you know, if you ask them the same, they will say exactly the same thing to you. But of course, at that time, there was a massive difference in the quality of living in China and in England. China had just come out of the Cultural Revolution period, which was, I don't know whether your listeners know much about that period, but it was an intense political period. China was cut off from the outside world. It was just opening up again, letting in capitalist ideas, and socialism and communism were sort of becoming replaced by, you know, capitalism, really. And of course, people's lives weren't as materialistic as they are now, and or certainly not as materialistic or material driven as they were back in the 1980s and 1990s here. And so people were fascinated by your watches, your clothes, let's say how much you earned. They wanted to know what it was like to live in the West. And we were the only people that they could talk to and see. So they really wanted to know, you know, how we lived, you know, what we did, what sort of, how our families were constructed. Was it, did they have the same values as us? And, you know, in those conversations, I think people are very honest. You know, we had some fantastic conversations learning about how people sort of thought differently, really, to us, because they had different pressures working on them. And all of these ideas, I suppose, I've carried with me. And it's, you've got to, in order to understand people, you have to listen to their stories, and you have to understand why they might be saying things that, on, you know, on first listen, a little bit strange to you, because you've been brought up in a different cultural environment. And yeah, that's a lesson I've learned and taken forward, yeah, both in my personal life and research, really.
Yeah, but would you say you now would do this? If you were to do it at this age you are now, would you do it now? Or do you think it was the enthusiasm of youth and bravery that allowed you to do it?
I think you're being very kind there, aren't you? I think you're right. I think I, at that point in time, I did have much more youth on my side, and I think it made me less cautious. Is that the right word? Yeah. I was able to throw myself into situations which, looking back now, I might not have been so brave to do. I think you gain confidence as you get older, and you become braver to do some things, but actually maybe some of the things I did were a little foolhardy, you know, and maybe I trusted people more than I should have, and, you know, but that's youth anyway, isn't it? But I'm glad I did it at that age, because I did. I saw so much of China. I traveled all the, you know, it was very cheap back then for us, relatively speaking. Obviously for people in China, it was very expensive to travel around. But for us, we could travel for 3 days on a train, and it wouldn't cost us, you know, it cost us sort of £30, and we'd have a bunk, and I could get from Beijing to Xinjiang and, you know, the far westernmost reaches of China, where people who sort of were very different to the Han people, who were the majority in mainland China, you know, it's a very Muslim area. So you felt that you really felt that you were in a country that was massive, that had different languages, that have different cultures, different ethnic groups. And it was a place to explore. And I think I still feel like I'm exploring the country now. I would never say that I'm an expert of China. Anybody who says that's a fool. Yeah. I specialize in learning and researching and teaching about China. But I wouldn't say I was an expert, because, you know, the language itself is so difficult to learn. Yeah. It's taken me a lifetime. I'm still learning more and more as I work. But yeah, it's a country of lots of mysteries and lots of surprises. And I think, you know, I'm glad I took this route.
Have you actually been anywhere else other than China?
I've also studied and lived in Taiwan, I know that's very similar to China because they speak Mandarin there as well. Yeah. But actually, I felt it was a really, really different country. I felt
in what sense?
In the sense that at the time when I was there for the first time, it was China was still, I suppose, to sort of again catching up. It wasn't the big economy that it was that it is now. It's the standard of living was very different to Taiwan, which was seen as much more of a sort of a developed nation. You know, it had got these massive industries that were supplying the world with technology, and you could feel there was money there. Yeah. But also because Taiwan hadn't been close to the world in the same way that China was, it had a much more cosmopolitan, global outlook. So people were, they were sort of wearing Japanese and Western fashions. They were much less impressed by seeing foreigners. They'd been seeing them all the time. And I think, when you, at the same time in China, you could have people coming up and sort of touching your hair and just sort of, not sort of caring about physical boundaries, because they were so, they'd never seen foreigners before. They'd never experienced them. So the cultural ways people sort of interacted on a sort of social level were really different as well. And, there were the skyscrapers in Taiwan as well. And nowadays you can't walk anywhere in China without seeing skyscrapers and luxury goods shops and people driving around in Mercedes and fancy cars. But back in the 1990s, that was really different. So just the same sort of cultural heritage just across the Taiwan Strait, and you got a really, really different experience.
Yeah. So you felt less special in Taiwan than you did in China.
Sorry, can you say that again? Sorry, I missed that.
So you felt less special in Taiwan
than you did
in China.
Yes, I didn't feel as special.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, where did your interest for sociology come in? Your life then?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think my initial interest, I think because China has such a long history, a long written history of 2,500 years, we think of China of sort of culture and I don't know. All things cultural, I think, were the things that sort of stood out to me. And I was very interested in the literature and the plays and the music because it felt so different. But the more I visited China and the more I got to see sort of modern China and contemporary China, I think that then started to pique my interest in people rather than cultural. Yeah. Things and so gradually over time my interest shifted to try to understand Chinese society. Why has Chinese society developed in such a different way to the Western experience? And I say that in a way that I don't want to be comparative, because I think it's sometimes a bit useless comparing different societies or different cultures, because what it tends to do is you tend to essentialize or you tend to other what isn't your experience. And I was particularly conscious of that. I mean, I really wanted to understand how China had become, Chinese society had become what it is today. And that's where I started to, I think one of the things that really sort of captured my interest was poverty. And one of the things I did notice from the very moment of landing in Beijing, going back to that point we were talking about earlier, is poverty was around us everywhere. And I think poverty is around us here in England, but often it's hidden poverty and we don't see poverty because it's behind closed doors and it's just not as visible. But in China, and still in China today, it's everywhere. And I think you can't help be struck by the gap between at the time, it was the gap between the wealth of the West and the relative poverty of people, a lot of groups of people in China at the time. But now what I see is the poverty gap between elite, rich Chinese people and other people in China. And you see it in the cities. So, for example, if you go to Beijing or Shanghai, these big, I mean, they're full of skyscrapers, those luxury goods, people living a highly materialistic lifestyle. Yet you look down on the pavement and there are people begging. And these are people who clearly have, you know, have nothing. And so this is coming to the reason why my attention then shifted to sort of the most vulnerable in Chinese society today and disabled people, is why a lot of people who are begging on the streets in China are actually disabled in some way or another. And also the street performers, they're often blind performers, for example, or they have they are an amputee and they're doing sort of tricks for performing, you know, performing for the crowds passing. And I think it really brought home the ways in which disability in China and disabled people in China felt to me as some of the most vulnerable in society. And I'm not taking away their agency in any way in that, but what I'm trying to say is that when I first encountered them, it was almost as a spectacle, and that felt really strange to me. The fact that people were feeling the need to, or being forced into, because we know that there are gangs that sort of take disabled people around and use them, sort of pimp them out in a way and make money off them. But, you know, everybody else was then looking and staring at the disabled performers in a way which I felt was, I could see that there was this power dimension going on. And it felt really uncomfortable to me, somebody who'd grown up in England. And the only thing I can really liken it to, and I'm sure your listeners, you know, are very familiar with the notion of the Victorian freak show. And it felt, it really felt as if disability was a spectacle. Mm. And non-disabled people were there to gaze and at disabled people and reassure themselves that somehow that, you know, being able-bodied or non-disabled was a better situation. And, you know, they could pity the disabled performers, the disabled beggars, and they would then sort of leave their money, you know, give them the charity and walk away and well, literally and figuratively just walk away from them. And so I sort of started being interested in poverty, but the disability then came very quickly as a partner, you know, partner with that.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that in the UK, maybe not to the same degree, but I always come across the idea of able-bodied people and, like, quote-unquote normal people suggesting what any disabled people that they know, why can't you do exceptional things? Why can't you be a genius? Why can't you do this, that, the other, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
They always want their disabled person to be able to be exceptional. We as disabled people are only considered worthy unless we're doing something exceptional, which it really annoys me half the time. Partly because I'm not exceptional in any way, so maybe I'm just bitter, I don't know.
But isn't that the point, though? I mean, I really take that point from Stella Young, you know. I mean, she comes up with this idea of the super crip, and she says, look, you know, why do I have to be exceptional all the time?
Yeah.
You know, what does that make you, you know, you're looking at me and you're wanting me to be exceptional. And I think it's hugely problematic on lots of levels. And I think what you've just said is just right, because if disabled people are to be valued by non-disabled people because they do exceptional things, what happens when you can't do exceptional things? What happens if you're just normal?
Yeah. you're a bit buggered, aren't you, then? You know what I mean?
You can only feel bad about yourself, surely.
You bet.
It's a real problem, isn't it? Because you feel, because then you feel as if you have to perform disability, the disability that is acceptable to non-disabled people.
Yeah.
And
the other question I wanted to ask you that arose from what you were saying was, I know this is difficult to answer, but you're just closer to it than I am, I suppose. That's the reason I'm asking, is that when you come across those well-to-do rich people in China, do you get the sense that they're happy within themselves?
I don't know. without directly asking them, I really wouldn't know. But I think because China's gone so very quickly from a country of relative poverty to a country where there is such richness around, then that is, and it's not just that it's around, it's the government actively encourages people to get rich. And one of the things that has sort of been driving the development of China is a vision called the China Dream or the Chinese Dream. Yeah. And this was this idea came from President Xi Jinping, who wanted to create new values for China when he came into position. And the Chinese Dream, in a way that's a bit like the American Dream, is a dream of wealth. It's a dream of entrepreneurship. It's a dream of having the good life. It's a dream of not being in poverty and being able to do nice things and be educated and get a good job and support your family. And so in a way, the government, the Chinese state, the government itself has driven a desire among people to live that good life. And so I suppose when you then end up living that good life and you've got stuff and you're demonstrating to others that you've succeeded in this dream, then maybe they do enjoy it. I don't know, but it's quite strange because I don't think we have anything similar in England and the UK. I don't really want to bring up the B word and Brexit, but maybe that was somebody's dream, but we don't have a national dream that is promulgated and sort of everywhere. You know, you don't walk around seeing posters of the British dream or anything like that, or we don't have a concept of that. So it's quite difficult for us to think about how people become satisfied with their lives. But I suppose achieving the Chinese dream is a way for people to feel that they're contributing and being successful in Chinese society today.
And I'm going to ask you perhaps what now is a difficult question again. I'm only asking you because I'm interested in sociology and the study of man. So what I'm asking you is, like you told me when you went on the train all them years ago, people were touching the air and doing all kinds of boundaries. But 30 odd years later, with the country going through what it's gone through and in this rich revolution, right? Material revolution. Do you think the same would happen now if you went? Or do you think the money has changed the culture in such a way that has change the mindset? Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question as well. And I think China is such a complex country. If that would not happen in an urban area, you know, I think, in fact, it's almost tipped the other way. And there is a who's excited about foreigners? That's the attitude this day. Who cares about foreigners? You know, okay. It's, you know, because there's a sense of, I think the country has got to a point, and the ways in which nationalism and patriotism are all sort of developed within the country, it's intensely nationalistic and patriotic curriculum, for example, from, you know, from the time kids go to school, they're taught how to be patriotic, how to love their country, how to understand that Chinese culture and society is a superior culture and society. So that has now become embedded in the psyche, I suppose, of Chinese people, that it becomes natural then to disregard or even look down on people who don't, you know, who aren't Chinese. So I think it's flipped within the last, you know, 30 years. Certainly, yeah. I've seen a real change. But I think the difference is when you go to more rural areas, where people, you know, seeing a foreigner is quite a new thing. There are lots of areas of China that are economically underdeveloped, you know, that really have very little contact with the outside world, and they see things through television. But even there are lots of communities that don't have television, and they're still, that they haven't been as influenced by these new forms of education, you know, political education. So seeing a foreigner is still exciting. So I've been sending students to China for many years since I went, and you know, they do come back with tales of unusual encounters with people in the countryside, and that, you know, it's in a way it's nice, it's curiosity, isn't it? And people's nature is to be curious. People want to know about the things they don't understand, and that's all it is. So for me, I didn't mind it, you know, it just it was a bit weird, but you just have to sort of say, okay, yeah, they just want to know. They want to see whether a foreigner's skin feels the same, whether their hair feels the same, or, you know, they want to tell somebody that they've touched a foreigner's hair, you know. So it's I can understand it. It's being curious, and we're all curious in our own ways, but you know, I think understandings of boundaries they're just different. They're culturally different, aren't they?
I suppose I could have asked that question in a much more simpler way. Have Chinese become less curious? That's essentially essentially what I was asking. I should have.
Thank you for rephrasing that, because I think that actually, that makes it easier in a way to answer as well, because possibly certainly less curious about non-Chinese peoples. Yes. Yeah. And I think that comes with a sense of confidence in the nation. And it would be interesting, I think, to see what would happen in another 30 or so years, because what we know is when nations become extremely confident, and, you know, if we go back to when we, in Britain was empire building, when nations become confident, they then really do other and look down on nations that aren't as well developed, and they view them as exotic, they view them as less developed. And it would be interesting to have this conversation in 30 years, if I'm sure you'll be around, but maybe not, I don't know, I hope so, but you know, if we go back to China and see whether that is, they've tipped that needle, has tipped all the way to the other side. So this sense of this strong sense of national superiority, which comes from nationalism, a belief and ideology that your country is better than others, has then tipped. So they're looking down. I mean, who knows where the UK will be at that point in time, and they're looking down on us, and they're curious about us as an underdeveloped nation.
Yeah.
You know, it could be the opposite way of things.
I think it could happen. I look forward to inviting you in 30 years' time.
I'd love to come back if we're both here.
And it begs the question, like, don't you think it's slightly weird that these developed nations now still look to the West and, like, don't want to copy their ideas, even though their ideas aren't generally that good? You know?
Well,
I just find it bizarre.
Yeah, I think one of the things that China has been very good at is it's never wholesale adopted ideas from the West. In they've always had this idea that we will learn from more developed countries or the West, which is, has been historically, but we'll take what we need and make it adapt and fit. You know, we're not going to take things wholesale. And you know, there's this phrase that that's been banded around, everything, I don't know, for example, capitalism with Chinese characteristics or something with Chinese characteristics. They're very good at saying, okay, we'll take that bit of that idea or that process and we'll mold it so it suits our purposes. So they, I think they've been, that, that's been sort of the way that they've engaged with outside ideas to some extent. I think there are other things that they've done that that I think more problematically, they've accepted ideas from my own research, really thinking about ideas, sort of eugenicist ideas or ideas about quality of human life. I think in a way they did take some of the worst aspects of, you know, scientific ideas that were coming around in the 19th and early 20th century and use them to justify some of the things that they've done for vulnerable people. But
And I promise we will get on to disabled people, but I just think it's a missed opportunity on my part to not ask you some of these other questions.
It's fine.
and not to just have you as a one-trick pony, you know?
Thank you. I have many tricks.
I don't want to do to you onto you what the people do onto me, so or vice versa.
Yeah. You
know? And the other societal question I had for you, or a mindset question, was that just popped into my head as I'm talking to you, was that do you think the Chinese have the same kind of imperialist mindset as the British did? Because let me just clarify that by saying, the reason I say that is because my family are originally from Pakistan, and China owns a lot of Pakistan land now. So that's what makes me think, do they have that kind of mindset where they want to spread out into other countries and do that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a really good, I think, analogy, actually, or at least try to get us to think about how some of what China is doing appears to resemble what the British Empire did in its day to places like Pakistan, India, and Africa, and gosh,
everywhere.
But it does. I mean, I think there is something different about it, though. I mean, one of the stated, I suppose, positions of the Chinese government is that it's non-expansionist, and a lot of what we see today in terms of the way in which China is laying claim to lands around China is part of its belief that historically those lands were and those seas were Chinese. I can't get into that debate because I'm no historian of those, or I'm not into political sort of boundary. I don't know about these disputes.
No.
But what we do know about the stated position of the Chinese government is they are very keen to tip the balance away from the dominance of the West. And I think what they want to do is they want to see a rebalancing of the world in terms of that doesn't privilege constantly Western ideas and historical Western power. Which is completely understandable for a country that's, you know, economically taking itself, you know, into the stratosphere, and you know, it wants to see that power, that, you know, that the respect really that it feels it has been denied, and it comes from a historical perspective. Really, I mean, lots of parts of China were actually under you know, the British, under the British Empire's control, under, you know, parts of it were controlled by Germany, Japan, the Netherlands. All of these imperialist powers had land in China. And I think, so from the 18th, 19th centuries, China became, sort of went through, they call it a century of humiliation. And all of this, what we see now today with China buying up land everywhere else, is part of that trying to restore the respect that the country feels it's due, to sort of get rid of that humiliation narrative, to rebuild itself as a power that's respected for its cultural heritage, for its military might, for its scientific advances, all of these things. And part of it is then going to other countries. And so it's become, it's going out to other countries. It's primarily doing it through trade in the first instance. But what we also then see as the country goes out with this much more confident mindset is that then it starts to sort of change the places where people go. And there's a lot of work being done on the ways in which Chinese money and Chinese business is changing recipient countries in Africa, for example, South America, even in the Mediterranean, for example. We've got, you know, Cyprus is being, huge swathes of property is being built, bought up by Chinese investors in Cyprus. And other countries, I hasten to add, but it just, it changes the balance. So China, in a way, this is part of soft power. You know, people, the ways in which minds are changed through culture, but also through money and influence. And it's not always an obvious thing, but when the dynamics are changed slightly, so for example, when Chinese money goes into Africa, it doesn't come for free. It comes with, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine, you know, and then people become sort of more connected to China, more willing to listen to the Chinese government's perspectives, more willing to sort of, you know, be shifted away from where they may have had their vision or their ties in the past. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just something that happens, isn't it? Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you, you know, just so that somebody listening kind of thinking that way, China bashing. As far as I'm concerned, without China bashing, I'm just trying to understand and give everybody else understanding. And in that spirit, I want to ask you, can you give me three misconceptions that the West has of China that you just wish people would get in their heads and they misunderstand China in certain ways? Is there three things that you could give me? Or
yeah, no.
What did you like?
I don't know. I've got that many, but I think one of the first things that I think needs to sort of be spoken about a bit more is this idea that China is a collective society, and that China somehow is this homogenous entity where people all act as a collective and things, and that's not true. I mean, I think even during the Maoist period, when Mao Zedong was leading China in the sort of 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, and even in the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and 70s, individualism was there. You know, I think the balance has, you know, shifted over time, whether people felt pressured to be more collectivist in their ideas rather than individualist. And people are saying now, you know, China has become much more individualistic, but somehow there's a very persistent idea that China, all Chinese people are very collectivist, and that's not actually true. And I think it's really unhelpful, because it just, these sweeping assumptions and generalizations don't do anybody any good. I mean, in the same way that Chinese people are told that here in the UK we're all individualistic and we don't care about the collective, well, I don't think that's true either. And if anything, the recent COVID pandemic has shown that actually people work together in a collective way as well as anywhere in the world. So you know, it's thinking about trying not to look at China and just take stereotypes and assumptions and do that and to look at them that way. Another stereotype probably is the idea that Chinese people are all sort of very hardworking, industrious ants in this collective idea. And Chinese people are very, very hardworking. And I suppose that is partly driven by this China dream, this idea that you're only as good as the effort that you put in. And by getting a great education and working hard, you can you can get yourself out of poverty and support the national growth and things. But that idea that we have comes from a really dark place, because it comes from the 19th century, where the idea that Chinese workers were, that we call them coolie in Chinese, that's translated as literally as hard labor. And you know, the idea of a coolie, that a Chinese person would work you know, really, really hard, sort of stuck into our imagination, and that they would then work for the collective like an ant and until they dropped. I mean, sure, there are extremely hardworking people in China, but there are also people who aren't. So it's about taking these assumptions, these stereotypes about a particular nation that often people don't know very much about, and trying to disentangle those. I mean, in the same way, I mean, I'm sure Chinese people have lots of assumptions about life in the UK. And it's only by coming here and talking to us and living here and visiting here that they can sort of see some of those assumptions that they're told by the press, by the state, that they're told in their literature, in their culture, in their film, that they're not quite as true as they thought they might have been. And that's again, it goes back to that point I was making at the start. You know, I was intrigued by the culture, by the literature, and you know, are the stories that we hear about China or have heard about China, are they, you know, to what extent are they true or anywhere near true in some instances? And they're not. When you go somewhere and you experience and you talk to people and you learn the language, I think is really important too.
Do you think if you would have switched the TV on 30 odd years ago to what you switched the TV on now in China, what would the programs be completely different?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yes. I think sort of 30 years ago, that, I mean, in all honesty, it was a bit like here, there weren't many channels, but yeah. I think there was, and I think it's gone through a change. So talking about the 1990s, there was a big explosion in television and that sort of media. And a lot of it was, you know, emulating what, you know, what would happen on Western television. But there still wasn't a whole lot of Western film and television in China. It did come, but it's almost gone full circle, really. Chinese television and media and culture has become less influenced, I think, by elsewhere, and it's because it's developing its own track now. And again, it's part of this government sort of driven desire to clamp down on ideas that don't conform to their vision of Chinese culture. And so in recent times, there has been a lot of talk in the media, but also, we know it's happened, of censorship of, for example, rap culture and hip hop culture, which is massive underground culture in China. You know, this was one of the sort of major subcultures in music. And so the variety of rap and hip hop you see now on Chinese television is very much a Chinese version of that, which I suppose in this way is a good thing, but it's because of the censorships and controls, it's very different to what it could have been if those censorships and controls weren't in place. And one of the things that I talk to my students about every year is about how, because we assume in our cultural sense of superiority that English language films and, you know, Hollywood, or I don't know, Pinewood Studios, all of these films that come out of in the English language are as much hits in China as they are here. Well, I can tell you that they're not. If you look at the list of all the bestsellers and blockbusters in China, they're predominantly Chinese. I think there are a few English language ones that have made into the list. I think it's probably Avengers or something like that. I don't know. But in a way, I suppose it's very similar to the superior, the strength of Bollywood within the Indian subcontinent. You know, why should we look at Hollywood and other cultures worth of cinema when we've got a very nice cinema culture going on here? Thank you very much. And so it's quite interesting that, you know, there have been attempts to bring together Hollywood and I don't know what you'd call it, Chinawood, whatever it is, and in really odd sort of combinations. So there was the film probably a couple of years ago, I don't know whether you went to see it, was The Great Wall with Matt Damon in it.
Yeah.
It was a really weird movie. I love Matt Damon. I mean, love him. I mean, in Master, he was great. But, you know, in this film, not so much. And you could see how that Hollywood has been trying to speak to Chinese cinematic audiences and failing dreadfully. Yeah. But what we have seen, and again, vice of is sort of looking at it from the other way, we're beginning to see a lot of Chinese superstars appearing in Hollywood movies. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously people are talking about Michelle Yeoh at the moment. I mean, she's not from mainland China, but, you know, she sort of represents Chinese cinema because she's been in so many mainland Chinese films. Yeah. But, you know, lots of other people who are sort of superstars in China are appearing, Fan Bingbing, Li Bingbing, they're in The Meg, and all sorts of other big Hollywood stars. And it's almost as if, I don't know whether Hollywood is trying to get a foothold in China by getting Chinese stars in their movies, but certainly they're finding it difficult. And again, it's all about cultural expectations, you know, what Chinese audiences want to watch. And often it's not a load of white people running around saving the world, basically. They want to see Chinese people saving the world. And
I've seen there's a rising a crackdown on censorship in India with the Modi government, and the Pakistani film industry is a bit like that as well. It can be a bit like that because Pakistani film industry is called Lollywood. You know, with countries becoming more nationalist, censorship boards seem to have more of a say.
I mean everything that's shown in China has gone through various levels of official but also unofficial and self-censorship. So and some of the most successful films recently have had a very sort of nationalistic sort of bent, but they're hugely popular as well, and people you know love to go and watch them. And you know, people want to see superheroes and heroes and heroines you know that look like them, and that's completely understandable.
Right, now moving on to your book, could you give us the title of your book first, please? The full title. Right.
Yeah, I always get it wrong, actually. It's Disability in Contemporary China, Culture, Identity and Citizenship.
What I wanted to ask you first up was, do you think having your daughter, what kind of impact do you think having your daughter, who has cerebral palsy, if I'm not mistaken, what kind of impact that had on you writing this book?
I think it was really fundamental, actually, because I mean, she was born with cerebral palsy, and I think ever since she came into our lives, you know, as a family, we're a disabled family, and we're living life with her, and you know, our lives have changed for the better in so many ways because of her, and we've met so many people. And I could see, though, as she was growing up, that the ways in which society and other people, I don't know, sort of their behaviours change around a disabled person in ways that are sort of sometimes understandable and sometimes not at all very understandable. Mm-hmm. And it's I suppose thinking about, you know, when you're impacted personally by an experience, I think you sort of things start to sort of fall into place, and then you sort of start to click about, oh, okay, now I see why people are so upset about that, or I can understand now what people are saying when they said this, or I now understand what I'm seeing. And I just, it's like, it's almost like a veil has been lifted from your eyes. And so what I felt was, having had that experience, that I felt more confident that I could at least try to think about disability in China in a way that people hadn't done before. Well, in fact, nobody really had. There were some books that were written about disability in China, but not many. And so it was, and one of the things I did, one of the talks I gave quite a long time ago now, COVID seems to have sent my sense of time warp, so I don't know how long ago it was. It probably wasn't very long ago, but I felt that what right did I have to do this book, because and do this research that I was doing, because I had what I felt were so many lenses in front of my eyes, that here I am, a white woman who is non-disabled, who is living in England. I'm already looking at China, which is a different culture. Mm. And then I'm going to be looking, I mean, funny enough, one of the first articles I wrote was about the experiences of a disabled man. You know, I'm a woman, I'm writing about man's experiences. Yeah. I'm non-disabled, I'm writing about disabled. I felt I've got so many lenses in front of my eyes that, you know, who was it, you know, what right did I have to do that? And I suppose that I think very quickly you sort of have to think about what advantages your perspective could bring, but also you have to be very attentive about how your experiences and perspectives could also be a disadvantage. And I think,
what do you mean by that?
Well, in a way that I didn't want to be seen as, I think I wanted to make sure that I was listening as carefully as I could to the stories that I was hearing, and that in a way that when I did interpret what I was hearing, that I was doing it in the most culturally informed and nuanced way I could. So I think that meant, in the first instance, I mean, I felt that after at this point, I've probably been, you know, writing, learning Chinese for many years, and I felt I had a bit of a grip on the China side of it. But what I felt was, although I had my personal experience of disability, I didn't have an academic experience of disability. So one of the things I did to start with was educate myself. And I think that's really important, that I sat down and I said, look, you know, I need to understand how disability has been understood by activists, by educators, by academics historically, so I can then see whether those ideas will help me to sort of look at disability in China. And of course they did. They were really, really fundamental to the way in which I then started to look at disability in China. But what I noticed really quickly is that theories and ideas and concepts that are developed in a particular cultural context or social context are very much informed by that social context. And so here in, you know, I'm sure your listeners are all very aware of the social model and the medical model, all of these models of disability, the human rights model, that they all come from a very particular perspective. So the medical model, you know, is individualizing the disability to the impairment level, to be cured and rehabilitated. We've got the social model that came as a reaction to that, you know, and it's great that British scholars and activists were a very fundamental part of the development of the social model and the ways in which society, you know, is a source of oppression and the barriers to living in for disabled people. And then the human rights model has obviously developed on from that, and we now have the Convention on Rights of Persons with a Disability, with disabilities, which informs global ways of thinking about disability. But, you know, if I took the social model and I sort of was using it as a lens to look at China, and I was listening to Chinese people talk about their disability, and I read a lot of memoirs, you know, people's writings, because I love listening to extended stories about their lives and their experiences and their hopes and their desires. And if you take those social model understandings, I couldn't understand what I was seeing and listening to in their stories, because everything they were sort of saying to me, their stories were of hope and positivity. But actually, a lot of what they're experiencing, to my mind, was oppression and discrimination. Yeah. And I couldn't understand why that was. And I thought, you know, if we're going to take these Western lenses and apply them to China, we're not going to get the full story. How can somebody feel so positive about their experience and be living a fulfilling, rewarding life, in their own words, where actually, you know, if we took that person and we looked at them in a different way, we couldn't understand that. So I think we'd miss those stories. And I'm, you know, one of the things I was really keen to do was not be judgmental about what I found. And I think lifting that lid of judgment about, you know, how on earth could you be happy? You know, this would be awful, you know, if it's just awful, you know, experience. Don't you see how awful that is? And then I feel so valued. My life has value. Yeah, and you know, and you can't go to somebody and say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, here in the West, we say that you're loved.
Yeah.
Discriminate, you're oppressed. Your life have value, and they're feeling something completely different. So.
Yeah.
So to me, it was immediately clear that what these ideas and concepts and, you know, ways of looking at the world are really valuable, because they've changed fundamentally the ways in which disabled people are able to sort of articulate and act, you know, fight for rights and things.
Yeah.
But what happens in China, where people, there's no history of activism in the same way, where... Where, you know, if you start parading down the street holding banners and stuff, you're more likely to be, you know, you're not going to be there much longer, because there are so many controls on what you can and can't say, on, you know, whether it's marching down the street or whether it's...
Well, it's getting like that here.
Online, you know.
Well, it's getting like that here.
Exactly. But, you know, so how does a country... Or how do things change, I suppose? And the ideas that I sort of developed through my book was showing how China has changed over time, where it gets its ideas about disability from. I mean, so some of them from, you know, medical scientific models that we've had here in the past. Some of it has been informed a bit by the social model, and there's an idea, yes, barriers are put in by society.
Yeah.
But China is a signatory of the CRPD now, one of the early signatories, and they've tried to integrate some of those understandings into legislation and support and social support and other things. But you know, what my research has shown is that underneath it all, there are things that are really entrenched, and that we have to see disability as a socially and culturally constructed phenomenon. So, for example, in the law on the protection of disabled persons in China, there is, all the way through, it refers to disabled people. I mean, even the definition itself of disabled people are people who cannot function normally. Yeah. And I'm quoting directly from the law. Yeah. Okay, so already from the start, and this is a law that has been amended since the CRPD it was signed by China, there's still this understanding that there is something abnormal about disability and impairment. So, and that's in the law. And it's not just that. If you go further down into the law, and this is what really sort of fascinated me as part when I was sort of doing the research for the book, was that there's a phrase that, and it talks about what are called the four selves. So it's self-belief, self-confident, self-confidence, self-strengthening or self-improvement. There's sort of self-support, you know, so there's all these selves that that sort of situate the responsibility for being successful with yourself. And the law says that disabled people in China must adopt a spirit of being self-reliant, self-supporting, self-believing. So even within the law, it tells disabled people to get up and sort themselves out and do something about their own situation, which is really odd, you know. And it's everywhere. These phrases are everywhere. And everywhere I looked, I kept coming back to this phrase of a spirit of continual self-strengthening or self-improvement. So it wasn't just that you could do it for a bit, you had to keep on doing it, you know, keep on, you know, getting over yourself, you know, triumph over your own tragedy. And it's very neoliberal, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can see where it's coming from. The state really hasn't got enough resources to look after, but sort of give dignity to and support where needed. And you know, this is a really handy way for a very neoliberal sort of approach where there's no welfare, no support, you know, very few rights, and it's your fault. You need to
get over
yourself. So really, it is that triumph over tragedy sort of approach, isn't it? And so you can understand it. You can understand it's there. And so, but it's really appealing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really sort of captured my imagination, is that when people always seek recognition and value, don't they? Yeah. I mean, we don't go around going, well, I don't care what somebody thinks of it. Well, some people do. Okay.
Most
human beings seek validation. They seek to know that other people around them feel that their life is worth living.
Yeah.
And, you know, for disabled people in China these days, and for, you know, for the past sort of few decades, it really has been a sense of, if you can do something to show that your life is worth living by being productive, a productive citizen, then, you know, society will value you. And and they're, you know, they're given awards and, you know, ceremonies for being a great disabled person and a model disabled citizen. And generally, going back to that this idea we're talking about, sort of super crips and things, you know, the more exceptional, the better. Because what it does is it's not necessarily a message to disabled people, although it's supposed to chivvy them along to be better productive citizens. It's a message to everybody else. And what that message is saying to everybody else is, you see those people over there? Okay, you have much more than they do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're, and I'm inverted commas here, they're the normal people. If you was a normal person, I'm wagging my finger at you here, aren't I? I've just seen myself. You know, if you as a inverted commas, quote, quote, normal person can't do even half as much as that abnormal person over there, you're rubbish, you know? So you can see why it's attractive to have that validation that you're a worthwhile person in society, and, you know, and they believe it. And but it's very difficult then to counter that, because it feels bad that you're sort of saying that. No, hold on a minute, you know, society's got it wrong. And it's very difficult to change culture. I think it's one of the most difficult things we can change. But going back and just to explain it a little bit more, is historically, you know, we have all sorts of terms that are not acceptable now to sort of describe an impairment or disabled people. And in China, sort of back in the day, if we're going back, well, how many years now? Okay, say 50 years now, people were called useless people. The term for a disabled person was a useless person, a rubbish person. So, and then it sort of transformed to be a rubbish and sick person, or a sick and rubbish person, useless person still.
Yeah.
And it's only recently, with sort of interactions with, the United Nations and the United Nations Decade of Disabled Persons and all of this and the CRPD, that they're sort of transitioned to a word which is still, it's deficient. If you look at the way it's made up in Chinese, is deficient and sick person. Doesn't sound much better, does it? But anyway, so it's sort of, they've gone from the completely useless people to the deficient and sick people. But what we can see are those ideas from the CRPD, human rights-based perspectives coming in, and people saying, well, actually, we want to see it through the social model. We want to see the fact that it's society is disabling us rather than us being somehow deficient. And they're trying to change the language again. And one of the words that they've been using is deficient and barrier. So they're building in the barrier into the word for a disabled person. But the really interesting thing is, so the activists and sort of the disability NGOs have sort of developed this new word, Sanjiang, and they're using it because they feel it reflects a social model and a human rights-based perspective. But actually, disabled people themselves, when they've been interviewed and talk about it, they hate the word because it's still got that deficient bit in it. Yeah. You know, we're not deficient, We don't want that word either. So there's even contest and negotiation about how to describe disability and disabled people in China. So it's an ongoing thing, and culture changes, society changes. It often changes very slowly, but what I like, and I'm really enjoying watching this conversation between people about what disability means in China, how do we ensure that people have dignity and respect, and is it through a change of terminology? Is it through better sort of awareness of, how to enable people to have a more independent lifestyle? What is it? And some of the stories are similar to what we've seen here in the UK, and some of them are quite different. And it's really interesting.
And I just want to say to you, just for, so I give you something as well, that, I'm talking to you as a person with CP, cerebral palsy myself, so you know where I'm coming from. And I just wanted to let you know that. And I also wanted to ask you, do you think we wouldn't have had this book if it wasn't for the birth of your daughter?
I don't know. I probably would have been there, because, that's where I was, my research was moving at the time, but whether it would have been like it is now, I don't know. I think it is very difficult for people outside something and experience to really, really understand what those experiences are. And what I'm trying to say also is that I still think this book isn't the end of the story. I think this is just the beginning of the story. Yeah. So thinking about, what needs to happen in future is I want to see disabled academics in China, of which there are very few, coming along and writing their own book about disability in China. Yeah. I'd really be interested in seeing how that comes along. But I think having, my daughter is, and her experiences have, I say, opened my eyes to a lot of things that I don't think I would have been as attentive to or understanding of, even if I'd noticed them in that way. And so I think that's been really valuable for me as a person, but also, I'm hoping it's brought something different to the book as well. I don't intend that I speak for disabled people in China through this book. What I've tried to do is listen and just understand, really. And I'm hoping that this concept of paracitizenship, which I've come up with, which I feel is more inclusive of a wider range of experiences. When you're sort of trying to theorize or come up with a concept that helps to understand people's experiences, you need it to be sort of as broad as possible. And I felt that with And again, this is where my daughter comes in, in sort of an odd sort of way. And she's a great athlete. So she's been doing a great new para sport called frame running. And it's now been approved by the IPA. And so hopefully at some point it's going to go into the Paralympics, fingers crossed. But doing para sport has also sort of was one of the things that sort of informed my ideas as well, because what I could see was, and a lot of people have written about this, these aren't my ideas necessarily, but I could see it happening, is the ways in which, you know, people who do para sport get an immense amount of pleasure out of it and a sense of achievement. And, you know, they are true athletes, and, you know, but also I've seen people doing a para sport, not as a competitive level. Yeah. And I can see that doing it for recreational purposes can create new bonds, new social friendships, new expectations and aspirations, and that's how we first got into it, and it really sort of changed her life, I think, and it changed her ideas about what she, you know, where she could go in the future. So I think sport, you know, whether it's recreational or whether it's competitive, I think is a great thing. But going back to this point about sort of the sort of para sport on a more competitive level, it was the idea that, again, going back to this super crip notion, that people were very critical of the ways in which para athletes and the way in which they were portrayed on television and extolled and, you know, rewarded on television made non-disabled viewers feel that that was the only acceptable form of being a disabled person. Is, again, you had to be exceptional, you had to break world records, you had to be physically fit of some variety. So, but also I could see it from the para athlete side, and the fact that actually this on a personal level was very fulfilling and great for them. So this notion of para, that actually it could be both positive and negative, from different perspectives, I felt that was a really good pairing for citizenship. And I was also really keen to make sure that when a lot of people have researched citizenship and belonging for disabled persons, they often say, well, disabled persons in terms of citizenship, they are shadow citizens, they are half citizens, they're semi-citizens. Somehow they're always not full citizens. And again, in some respects, that might be true for a lot of people, and it also might be true for a lot of cultural contexts. But in various ways, people do find belonging and they do live fulfilling lives, and within very different frameworks. And I felt that we needed some sort of idea about how identity, belonging can be contested as well as negotiated as well as imposed upon. You know, why should it always be that non-disabled people are telling disabled people how to belong? You know, I think there's also a big conversation that is really important about disabled people saying, well, actually, this is how we want to belong, and this is how we want society to go, and this is how it would help us if you non-disabled people could do this instead. And I think it's a conversation, and it's not static, it's flexible, it's dynamic. And the more conversations we have with each other, across cultures, across generations as well, I think that would really help, because, you know, the young people today, I think, have really different ideas to I'm speaking for myself, obviously, and from my aged position. Young people like yourself might want to, you know, have different ideas about what it means. But I think, you know, we need to have a conversation. It's the conversation that's important, isn't it?
Right. And my last couple of questions. One is, do you think, it's a bit of a cheeky one, I suppose, do you think your book is already out of date?
Oh, probably, yes. No, I don't. That's not cheeky at all, actually. No.
Because it was published in 2020. So now we're 3 years on.
Oh. Yeah, no, not cheeky at all. And that book was a long time in the making as well. You, honestly, academics and academic presses take to get out. I mean, the paperback's just come out, and I, you know, what I think I would have liked to have done is to bring it up even more to date. You know, I feel I left it somewhere in the late sort of 2018-19, and it's and things change so fast, don't they? And I mean, one of the joys I've got now, I've just started a research leave, and my next project is really to bring everything up to date. You know, how have things changed since I, you know, in the 5 to 8 years since I started that project? You know, what's happening now in China, is what else has changed and things. So oh. yeah, it is out of date, but I think the big principles still apply. I think the big ideas are there, and I think what I hope is it gives people some ideas about how to understand disability in contexts both outside of the Western sort of areas, you know, thinking about how can we think about disability differently from a different.
This might be a bit bigger question for the end, towards the end, but I'll ask it anyway, because it just popped into my head. How do you think the COVID-19 has brought disability culture back in China? Do you think it's paused it, or do you think it's stunted its growth, essentially, is what I'm asking you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of horrifying stories that came out of China in the very early days of the pandemic was the story of a young boy whose father was taken in. He had cerebral palsy, and his father was taken into quarantine, and they basically forgot about him, and he died. Very, very sad story. And I think that arose a great sort of debate in the Chinese media about, you know, who are we as a society that we haven't got it right to make sure people like that young boy are protected. And, you know, disability culture is about ensuring that people have given the space to have sort of the dignity and independence and respect that everybody else is afforded as a right because of their able-bodiedness. And so I think what it did was it stimulated conversations in China that were new, and, you know, how could we as a people collectively be like that as a society? Whether that ultimately changes anything, I'm really not sure, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how things have changed in China since COVID. I mean, one of the things we know from our experience here in the UK is that COVID isn't just a virus and illness that affects you for 1 week. It can affect you for the rest of your life, and long COVID and other conditions that have stemmed from COVID itself are going to be doing equally the same sort of things in China. And so thinking about how a society acts and works in pandemic conditions as well as beyond pandemic conditions is going to be really interesting to see. Has anything in China changed through this experience? At this point, I really don't know. I need to get back out there. I'm hoping they're going to let me back in and do some more research there. But I'm looking forward to going back and seeing all my lovely colleagues over there.
Yeah, I just want to get you to clarify. Was it the boy who died or the father who died?
It was the boy that died. Yes, he was. Okay. Nobody looked. They just took him away, and nobody checked in on him. And unfortunately, he did die. So, I mean, we often say that tragedy often stimulates action. So whether that will or not, but what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be looking particularly at the media stories around COVID and disability, and see whether that the way in which people talk about disability is changed, and if that so, how has it changed, and is it really changing to ensure that disabled people have a better chance of living the China dream, maybe.
Yeah. Now, my next question is, my next thought is, I suppose, do you remember what one of the first things you wrote was when you wrote the book? If you take yourself back to the start of the book, what was one of the first things you wrote right in the book? Because I'm very interested in the creative process.
Oh, in the crazy, oh, crazy. Yeah, I mean, it was a long time in coming, and some parts of it I'd sort of written up before.
Yeah.
So really, I started the journey with the story of, and it comes in sort of later in the book, in chapter two, I think, about a woman called Zhang Haidi. Now, Zhang Haidi is somebody I've sort of been fascinated with for a long time, and she's currently the China Disabled Persons Federation president, and she's sort of probably the most famous disabled person in China. She was likened to Helen Keller in America and all sorts of things. So she was China's Helen Keller, and her spine was injured when she was young through an illness, and this was in the Cultural Revolution, and she was one of these stories that was picked up by the media in the early 1980s, and she became a model citizen for all young people in China. And it was really interesting about her story, about how she came to be so famous, what they said about her at the time, whether she was suitable because she was disabled or not, and all of this. But I used it to show what I would describe as the Zhang Haidi effect in China, is that her life then became the vision for everybody else who was disabled and non-disabled to live up to. So they had to be like Zhang Haidi, and you know, this person who overcame all her, you know, her impairments to triumph over tragedy and live a very productive socialist life. And so I wrote all about her first, because I felt that her story really bridged, set us off for contemporary China, because I don't think the attitudes towards disability in China today would have been the same without her. It goes back, the story then went back, I then went back, and then I went forward again. Yeah. So I started in the middle, went back in history, and then went forward and had a little look more. So writing a book is, I don't think, is linear. Maybe it is if it's fiction. I don't know. Maybe you have to start at the front and work to the end and the reveal. But yeah, I started in the middle, went back, and then went forward again.
And my final question, I suppose you'd be glad to know, is, just to prove I've been listening to you, is my question is, when do you think you'll be writing your own memoir?
I'd love to think that somebody would be interested in reading about my life, but I don't think I'm one of those normal people, I'm afraid. I've got nothing
to say about me. She says, after talking an hour and a half.
Oh, I didn't say I couldn't talk. No, that's one thing I'm quite happy to do. That's what you see, that's what I do. That's my job, isn't it?
Okay. So you have no plans to write your own memoir then?
Absolutely not. I don't think it would be interesting to anybody.
After listening to you throughout this conversation, I really think you should.
Oh really? But well, it's quite interesting. You know, you've probed me on China, on my time in China that I haven't really talked about for a long time, and I think it is more interesting than
not to be disrespectful or to make you feel bad, but I would say to you, get them down before you memory is a very disturbed mistress. So yeah, be careful.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's excellent advice. I will start my memoir tonight.
Okay. And before we go, is there anything else you'd like to say?
I think it's been really great to talk to you today, and you know, I think you've brought some things out of me that I haven't spoken about for a long time, and really got me thinking. So thank you very much.
And thank you again for doing this. It's been really informative for me and really enjoyable. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everyone. Bye.